Good evening. Is the mic on at a level that you can hear me in the back? Great. My name is David Scobie, and as director of the Harward Center of Community Partnerships here at Bates College, I'm delighted to welcome you to tonight's Civic Forum, a talk by the writer and environmental activist Bill McKibben on global warming, fighting against it, living with it. The Harward Center's mission is to integrate civic engagement across the Bates education through the fostering of community partnerships, community-based learning and research, co-curricular service, and environmental stewardship. Our goal in this work is twofold: to bring the gifts of a liberal arts institution into partnership with the larger community to help solve public problems, and in doing that, to make public work a source of innovation and transformation for our own work as educators. One important part of that mission is to convene discussions that explore, reflect on, and advance a democratic culture of civic engagement. And this Civic Forum series is especially important on that front. The series brings distinguished speakers to campus, advocates, activists, scholars, policy experts, to talk about important policy, political, and civic issues of significance to Bates, Maine, and beyond. Over the past year, we've hosted civic forums on engaged citizenship in the presidential election, homeland security and civil liberties, women's rights and women's activism, international perspective. Tonight's talk by Bill McKibben is our final forum of the year. Our topic, the global crisis of climate change and its consequence for our lives, couldn't be more important to Bates, Maine, and beyond. And we couldn't have more eloquent, important voice on that issue than Bill McKibben. Before I introduce Bill, let me just offer some thanks and a word or two about our format. My colleagues Peggy Rotundo, Brenda Pelletier, and Kristen Cloutier at the Harward Center deserve particular thanks for organizing both the year-long forum series and tonight's talk. The Bates Office of Communications and Media Relations helped spread the word, and our thanks also go out to Maine Public Broadcasting Network, which will broadcast an edited version of tonight's program, as it does with nearly all the civic forums, on its program Speaking in Maine. Finally, I want to offer a special shout-out to our many colleagues on the Bates campus doing groundbreaking, or maybe it's better to say ground restoring work on issues of sustainability, climate change, carbon neutrality, and support for local and regional food economies. Tonight's forum comes in the midst of a week-long program of activities on these themes, and Julie Rosenbach, Bates Environmental Coordinator, has our gratitude for weaving this forum into her program planning and publicity. Now, Bill McKibben. More than most of our speakers in this Civic Forum series, Bill does not need me to introduce him to you. The many hundreds of you in this room, you are here because you've been inspired, activated, educated, and maybe in some cases piqued and provoked by Bill's passionate and thoughtful writing or by the example of his activism. In books like The End of Nature, Enough, and Deep Economy, he's been an indispensable voice, often ahead of the curve, on the climate crisis, the economic and spiritual costs of consumer culture, the need for durable communities that offer sustainably and joyfully human lives. His writing by itself would have been a great gift, but he's also joined to it democratic activism, helping to organize action on global warming and carbon neutrality through efforts like Step It Up and the recent power shift demonstrations in Washington, D.C. He writes in the introduction to the Bill McKibben Reader, "It has been a great privilege to understand the possibilities of a literary life defined by commitment and service to place and planet." It's a great privilege for us to join him tonight in that space where the pleasures of writing, the need for social action, and environmental crisis come together. After Bill's talk, there will be time for questions and I hope a robust conversation. I'll be running around the space with a microphone and I'll ask you to speak into it so that we can have a good recording of your questions and comments to Bill. And if you do speak up, as I hope you will, we ask that you sign permission forms afterwards so that we can include your exchange in the MPBN broadcast. Now, join me in welcoming Bill McKibben.
Well, thank you all. It is a great pleasure for me to be here. Doubtless, considerably more of a pleasure for me than for you in the long run. I'm always very cognizant at these sort of occasions that I'm not really a, I'm a writer. I'm sort of self-selected to sit in my room and type, you know, and not only that, I'm sort of deeply behind the times, you know. I know that you're all used to seeing powerful PowerPoint presentations when people get up to speak. What I'll tell you is that I'm experimenting with a new low-carbon technology that I call virtual PowerPoint. And if it works correctly, you'll have to tell me afterwards, but if it works correctly, the pictures will actually appear in your heads as I speak, all right? It takes a little concentration. Also, apologize, because there's a sense in which my role in the world is to go around being a downer, you know? First book I wrote when I was not much older than, you know, 3 or 4 years out of college was a book called The End of Nature, okay? So you know what you're getting when you ask me to come talk. This is a nervous moment that we find ourselves in, nervous for all kinds of reasons, not the least of which the sort of daily ongoing drip of economic bad news. Bad news made more palpably scary because nobody really quite seems to know where the bottom of it is and quite how we'll get out of it and so on. I'm going to give you some other reasons to be nervous tonight along with that, and then I'm going to give you some reasons not to be nervous too. But I'm going to speak very frankly and pull no punches. We are in a difficult moment, and that moment maybe is exemplified by a phrase that we've heard a fair amount this last year in relation to the economic crisis, usually in relation to banks or insurance companies. We say that they are too big to fail, that if they ever did, they'd bring the whole system down with them. Well, it turns out that the financial system is not the only place where we've over-leveraged things, where we've built systems that are too big to fail and indeed are now starting to fail. And some of those systems are even more important than the global financial system. Indeed, let me begin by talking for a little while about global warming and say to you that the financial meltdown, scary though it is small compared to the meltdown, also underway at the moment. The damage from one will be measured in lots of lost productivity and lost wealth over a period of decades. The fallout from the other will be measured in geological time unless we're able to very quickly bring under control what we're doing to the Earth. Now, I wrote the first book about global warming 20 years ago, the first book for a general audience. And at the time, it was a hypothesis, this idea that humans were big enough to change everything that was going on the surface of the planet seemed, on the one hand, scientifically valid. We knew enough about the molecular structure of CO2 to be pretty confident that pouring as much of it into the atmosphere as we were by burning coal and gas and oil was a poor idea. On the other hand, it seemed emotionally counterintuitive. The idea that we had grown large enough as a species to fundamentally affect everything that happened on the face of the Earth, because that's, you know, except for tectonic and volcanic forces, everything else that happens on this planet derives its power from that increment of the sun's energy trapped in our narrow envelope of atmosphere. It seemed hard to imagine that we'd actually grown large enough to affect it all. And so science went to work really one of the most noble chapters in the history of science, and with more money and resources and human hours than we'd spent on any problem before, within 5 or 6 years, by about 1995, the world's climatologists were able to declare with pretty profound unanimity that human beings indeed were heating the planet and that it was going to be a very serious problem. And in the time since then, the 13 or so, it's as if the planet itself has been conducting a rigorous peer review of that research to make sure that it was correct. We've had all 10 of the warmest years on record since then, and we've begun to see not just, and here's the kind of news that I want to share with you tonight, it'll be news for some of you, begun to see not just confirmation of the fact that this global warming was going to be very dangerous. But in the last 2 or 3 years, really most markedly in the last 18 months, begun to sense, indeed more than sense, that both the scale and the pace of climate change are much larger than we would have guessed even 5 or 10 years ago. And that's the brief update I want to bring you tonight. What it went from hypothesis to consensus has turned, at least at the cutting edge of the science in the last 18 months, into a kind of panic, as scientists that I've been known for a quarter century, and who've always been concerned and sober and worried, are now very scared, and you can hear it in their voices and see it in their eyes when you talk to them. And it's because of this very rapid unraveling, the most obvious instance of which, and the one that caught everybody's attention, was in the summer of 2007, when we had extremely rapid melt of sea ice in the Arctic. Okay, sea ice has been melting in the Arctic for 30 years or so, and at a fairly steady rate. We've been losing, on average, about 1% a year. But in 2007, it was like it just fell off a cliff. We were losing an area of ice the size of California about every week through the late summer. By the time that season of melt finally ended in late September and the long Arctic night descended and things began to refreeze, by that point there was about 25% less ice than there'd ever been, at least in human history and actually for quite a long time before that. That's a very large change in a very basic physical system, something that was repeated this past summer. In fact, at points this past summer, both the Northwest and Northeast passages were open and you could navigate the Arctic, you could circumnavigate the Arctic on open water. Okay, very powerful. Powerful proof that things were warming up. There's no other reason why that would suddenly happen. Powerful reminder that the trouble we've caused is on the edge of veering beyond our control. The feedback loops implicit in events of that size are very scary. Just take that ice melt in the Arctic. You remove a white shield, white mirror, as it were, that reflects about 80% of incoming solar radiation right back out to space, okay? And you replace it with blue water that absorbs something on the order of 80% of that incoming solar radiation. You're amping up the reaction. And the point is that while we caused it to happen in the first place, burning all that coal and gas and oil, put enough carbon in the atmosphere to melt the thing, it is reaching the point where it's beyond, will be beyond our capacity to bring it under control. That is, even if we stop burning all that coal and gas and oil, the changes that we've created will continue to warm the planet. And there are a long, unfortunately, list of these feedback loops emerging. Maybe the scariest ones have to do in the last 18 months with a sudden spike in the amount of methane, CH4, in the atmosphere. Okay, CH4 is another potent warming gas. But in this case, it's not coming directly from us. We've actually done a good job of plugging natural gas pipelines and things to prevent leaks. Instead, what's happening is that a large amount of methane is stored beneath the tundra and the permafrost of the far north. And as we've, with carbon, raised the temperature of the planet and begun to melt that, it's seeping up into the atmosphere, seeping up quite quickly. Scientists the last two winters in the boreal north, in the coldest places in the northern hemisphere, in Siberia, in the dead of winter, have observed ponds and streams and marshes that aren't freezing because there's so much methane bubbling out through all the time that it's keeping them open. Research vessels this past summer in the Arctic Ocean observed large areas of the ocean with a methane foam across them, the clathrates, the frozen methane beneath the ocean. The ocean had warmed enough that this was now starting to melt, and big columns of methane bubbles were reaching the surface of the ocean. Okay? Those are very scary because we can't bring them under control ourselves. If we allow this carbon process to continue much longer, these systems will spin out of control. And that's enormously scary, because even the mild amount of climate change we've already caused has been enough to produce enormous results. So far, human beings have raised the temperature of the planet a little more than 1 degree Fahrenheit. All right? And that's already had enormous results. It doesn't sound like much, and 20 years ago we wouldn't have thought it was that much, but the planet turns out to be exquisitely balanced on temperature grounds, okay? And 1 degree was enough to wreak a lot of havoc. It's played all kinds of tricks on the hydrological cycle of the Earth. Warm air holds more water vapor than cold air. So in arid areas, you get more evaporation and more drought. And that's what we're seeing all over the world. The lead story yesterday in USA Today was about how around this country in the first 2 months of this year, there's been less rainfall totaled up than in any first 2 months of any year for which we have records, which goes back 150 years. The same thing is happening around the world. The Australian, you've seen the pictures of the Australian fires in the news. The Australian Meteorological Office said recently that they were no longer going to refer to what was going on in Australia as a drought, because that implied that it was going to come to an end at some point. They said this is, from what we can tell, the new normal. As the tropics have expanded, they've pushed the dry subtropics further from the equator, and that's the new normal for that latitude. Once that water's up in the air, it's going to come down. And so in wet places, we've seen great increases in deluge, in flooding, all over the world, with enormously difficult results for farmers, for infrastructure, for all kinds of things. At this latitude, the number of storms that drop more than 2 inches of rain in a 24-hour period, the really gully washers that do nobody any good, are up about 25%. Another big change in the basic physical phenomenon. Okay? We see the same thing happening with the intensity of storms around the world. Even with 1 degree, it's been enough to amp up both the number and the intensity of tropical storms, which of course draw their power from the heat in the first few meters of the sea's surface. If you don't believe me, and if you don't believe the scientists about that, then ask the insurance companies, because their record of payouts is extraordinarily clear. The damage increases almost exponentially as we get more and longer of these storms. Hurricanes now are lasting about a week longer on average when they form than they did 30 years ago. The sort of nature of them has begun to change in fundamental ways. That's with 1 degree. The consensus estimate is that unless we make very large changes very soon, we will see temperature increases on the order of 5 degrees Fahrenheit before the century is out. Okay, before lots of people in this room die, okay, we will see changes 5 times as large as the ones we've seen. And we can expect that the damage from those, the change from those, won't merely be linear, bad as that will be. What we've begun to understand is that there are a number of these equilibrium points, thresholds that we cross, in which we get very dramatic changes in state, physical state of all kinds of systems. This is by far the biggest thing that human beings have ever done. By far the scariest thing we've ever done. And also, it's worth saying plainly, by far the most immoral thing that we've ever managed to do in terms of its effects on people and other species around the world. Let me tell you just a small story to get across what I mean when I say that. A few years ago, I was thinking about this because we were talking about Bangladesh earlier today in one of these sessions. I was thinking back to the last time I was in Bangladesh, okay? Which is a great country. Are there people here who've been there? You must go if you haven't been. It's extraordinarily beautiful, one of the greenest places on earth. It's the delta of the great sacred rivers of Asia. The Ganges and the Brahmaputra come down out of the Himalayas. It's very crowded, size of Wisconsin with 140 million people, so half the population of the U.S., but so fertile from that silt that's deposited by the gentle flooding each summer that they feed themselves, okay? Quite a remarkable place, but in deep trouble. For one thing, those glaciers up in the Himalayas are melting quickly, okay? In fact, I've been in parts of Tibet. There's an area of about the size of Italy in Tibet where the world's largest concentration of alpine glaciers form the headwaters of the Yangtze, of the Yellow, of the Ganges, of the Brahmaputra, of the Salween, and of the Mekong. Okay? One in three human beings lives downstream from these glaciers, and not by accident. I mean, that's why they live where they live. The Holocene has been an extremely nice period in that our continental interiors have been free of ice, but we've had these beautiful frozen reservoirs up high in the Andes, up high in the Himalayas, the snowpack of the Sierra Nevada in our own continent that have watered over the summer billions of people down below. They'll be very out of luck in the next 10, 20, 30, 40 years as those glaciers dry up. They'll be very out of luck as sea level rises, and we now think it's quite possible sea level will rise 4, 5, or 6 feet in the course of this century. The Bay of Bengal is already pushing salt water high into, you know, much further into people's fields, contaminating wells. Bangladesh will be largely uninhabitable if any kind of sea level rise like that happens. But when I was there, the thing that was going on that had everybody's attention because it was more immediate than all of that was their first big outbreak of a disease called dengue fever, okay, a mosquito-borne disease, a mosquito, Aedes aegypti, that is exquisitely sensitive to changes in temperature and humidity and expands its range rapidly. Hence, the World Health Organization has predicted that it'll be the emergent disease of the 21st century. And indeed, its incidence so far this decade is already up 200, 300, 400% across South America and across Asia. The Brazilians had to open military field hospitals across the interior of the country last fall because the normal hospital emergency rooms, people were arriving at a rate of about 400 an hour, okay, with cases of dengue. I was in Dhaka, this city of 14 million in Bangladesh, when they had their first big outbreak, okay? And since I was spending a lot of time in the slums, I got bit by the wrong mosquito and came down with it myself. And it was as sick as I've ever been. It's a nasty tropical fever. They call it breakbone fever. But I, you know, obviously I didn't die, you know. Lots and lots of people there did. Old people, young people, sick people, whatever. I mean, by the hundreds were dying. And I remember going down to the hospital in Dhaka. Not that there's any treatment for it until you're in complete hemorrhagic, until you're bleeding from every orifice and then they can transfuse you. But other than that, there's no prevention and there's no treatment because only poor people have gotten it, so why would we have bothered really to, when we had important things like male pattern baldness and things to be worried about? This didn't rise to the top of the list, okay? But I remember standing there in a room much bigger than this, and it's filled with cots, and there's somebody shivering on every cot, and in between on the floor, because there's not enough cots, there's, you know, three times as many people just lying there shivering. And in between shivering myself, I remember looking around there thinking, these people have done nothing to cause this. The 140 million people who live, when the UN tries to figure out how much carbon each nation is emitting so that someday we'll be able to have an international agreement and do something about it, you can't get a number for Bangladesh. It's a rounding error in the calculations. Okay? The bicycle rickshaw is the main means of transit. Most people aren't connected to the electric grid. They don't for all intents and purposes, burn no carbon. The 4% of us who live in this country produce 25% of the world's CO2. The Chinese this year equaled us as CO2 producers, but there's four times as many of them, so on a per capita basis, we're still the champs. Anyway, the residence time of carbon in the atmosphere is a century, and we've been putting it up there for that long, so it'll be at least 40 years before the Chinese catch up with us as sources of this problem. Okay, 25% of the world's CO2. That means, in a kind of sloppy moral mathematics, that every fourth cot in that hospital ward was on us, you know, our contribution to their plight. And that stands in just one tiny symbol of what it is that we're doing around the world. This incredibly immoral act of making it impossible for people who are poor to begin with to be able to count on the one thing they always could count on, the basic physical stability of the planet, the thing that provides people their daily bread, who collect their bread daily. You know, it's a very big thing that we've done. The one piece of useful news that we have out of this last 18 months is a number to describe our situation. And that is a useful thing. Because global warming's been a grand experiment, right? We've been pumping all this carbon in, and we haven't known really how much is too much. We've suspected, but we haven't been having any real way to tell where the red line was. Before the Industrial Revolution, the atmospheric concentration of CO2 was 275 parts per million, and it had been that plus or minus 10 parts per million for all of human history. So call it the Eden number, or the Buddha number, or the Shakespeare number, or whatever your, you know, particular thing is, all right? We start burning coal and gas and oil, and the number starts rising, but we don't know where the red line is. 20 years ago, the number we tossed around a lot was 550 parts per million. Why? Because we had any... Not because we had any real sense that it was danger, because it was double what the old number was, and hence relatively easy to model on the computer. Okay, and so it sort of became, we started suspecting that was too high, and people started talking about 450 parts per million 10 years ago, but again, that was just a guess. When the Arctic melted, Jim Hansen at NASA, our foremost climatologist, and his team went back to work and produced a paper in January of 2008 that said that any value for carbon in the atmosphere greater than 350 parts per million, 350, was, and this was in the abstract of their scientific paper, not compatible with the planet on which civilization developed or to which life on Earth is adapted. Okay? Strong language. They were building this off the real-time observational data, but also the mountains of paleoclimatic data that we now have from ice cores and other things to allow us to understand how CO2 and temperature and sea level and things have interplayed over the years. It's a very tough number, 350, because we're already past it. We're at 387, going up 2 parts per million per year. We're just like the, you know, we used to think that we were like the guy who goes to the doctor and the doctor says, if you keep eating like you are, your cholesterol will get too high and you'll have a heart attack, okay? And so, okay, well, someday soon we'll stop eating like that or whatever. What we really were like was the guy, we didn't know it until 18 months ago, is like the guy who goes to the doctor and the doctor says, sir, your cholesterol is way too high. You're in that zone of greatly elevated risk, and any moment you can have the heart attack, and you better hope that you get your number down before that happens. We're having those heart attacks and strokes. That's why the Arctic is melting. That's why Australia is on fire. That's why all this stuff is happening, okay? Because we're way beyond where we should be. The Earth will scrub some of that carbon slowly. Oceans and forests will slowly take it away if we stop pouring more in. But the burden of the data was that we would have to do this soon. Soon. Hansen and his team said that if we weren't out of the business of burning coal as a planet by 2030, and in the Western world probably before that, we would put enough carbon in the atmosphere that we would never be able to get back to that number. So a very tough prescription. Okay, and one that I want you now just to hold in your head for a little while, because I'm going to switch gears for a minute and talk for a moment about stuff that seems entirely different. Maybe not quite so grim, so you can breathe for a little while if you'd like. I want to talk about what much of my intellectual work has been about in recent years, and it'll, with any luck, it'll eventually get back to that 350 in a second. But I've been very interested in questions of local economies and things like that. And one of the reasons was a kind of understanding that developed in my mind over the years that fossil fuel, the availability of cheap fossil fuel, has been maybe the single most important driver of events on our planet in the last 200 years. And it's had the effect of making us rich, and it's had the effect of wrecking our climate, but it's also had a third effect that we pay less attention to, maybe. Cheap fossil fuel has allowed our society, allowed each of us, to become really the first members of our species who have no practical need of our neighbors for anything, okay? Who can live lives of such autonomy and hyper-individualism that we barely need anyone around us for anything practical. What do I mean? Think about what the American project has been about for the last 50 years, since the end of World War II. Basically, most of our economic might has gone to the project of building bigger houses farther apart from each other. Okay? That's where we've poured our resources into. And the effects have been enormous. Some of them quite practical. That's the reason, more than anything else, that we pour so much more carbon into the atmosphere than anybody else. We've built a system that takes enormous amounts of energy to power those huge homes and then to drive between them, okay? But it's also had very profound effects on who we are. One of the big polling firms asks Americans every year the question, are you happy with your life? A pretty basic question. It must be a sort of disconcerting phone call to get right before dinner, you know. But the number of Americans who say, I'm very happy with my life, peaks in 1957 and goes slowly but steadily downhill. Not too much more than a quarter of Americans are willing to make that claim now, which is very odd, because in that same 50-year period, our material standard of living approximately trebled. Okay, we have endlessly more, you know, we have appliances to do jobs that we didn't even think needed doing 50 years ago. We can take vacations to places no one had ever heard of. We eat food flown in from everywhere. You know, we can, the right equipment, we can download any vaguely musical sound emitted anywhere on Earth in a matter of seconds, you know. Why hasn't it made us particularly happy? Well, to the degree that we can read the evidence, and I think we've become able to read it pretty powerfully in the last few years, is social scientists really dug into this data. To the degree we can read it, it's precisely because we feel a deep loss of connection with each other, a deep loss of community. And this is not some sentimental thing that we're making up, okay? The average American eats meals with friends or family or neighbors half as often as they did 50 years ago. The average American has half as many close friends as they did 50 years ago. That is to say, if you had been sitting in that seat 50 years ago in 1959, odds are that you would have twice as many close friends as you have now. Okay? That's a very large change for a socially evolved primate to undergo, you know? It's not you know, that many thousands of years ago that we were spending all our time sort of grooming each other and, you know, pulling lice out of our fur, you know. It's no wonder that we're not overjoyed. You know, we've built a system because we had this cheap fuel to underwrite it that allowed us to become very odd primates. And it hasn't been... I remember at the height of the last housing boom, before it collapsed our economy, I remember reading a story in the Times real estate section back when it was, so we were all still celebrating all the greatness of all of this. And the reporter was attempting to answer the question that had often occurred to me, which is, what exactly is in all those houses the size of junior high schools that you see sort of appearing across the landscape? And the answer turned out to be that a great many, not just the biggest houses, you know, most of the kind of starter castles for entry-level monarchs that we were putting up, you know, around the country, came equipped with dual master bedrooms, okay? That is, husband snores, wife pulls off the blankets, whatever. The American answer to this dilemma is 800 more square feet, you know? You got to heat it, you got to cool it, and it's a lot of energy, but the real problem is just what it says about us, you know? That the richest people on Earth were, you know, were so over-individualized that we were sort of, you know, sort of hunkered down in our own cave, staring out across the hallway at our mate. You know, it can't be healthy, right thing. We'd reached a kind of era of pure symbolic consumption, of which there were many, you know, good images. The SUV, an entire race of people living the sort of fantasy life of forest rangers, you know, driving around, you know. Or, to use an example very pertinent to Bates right now, the rise of the bottled water industry, you know. Yannick, I'm very glad to see this campaign you're leading on bottled water here on campus, because it's the perfect example of the kind of just pure consumption for consumption's own sake that we've, you know, everybody in this country, with very few exceptions, has, with great expense on the part of society, built up access to good, clean drinking water at the turn of a faucet. And yet somehow we were able to be convinced that what we wanted to do was purchase water from, you know, who knows where, and let it sit on a shelf in a plastic bottle for a few months and then drink it. I mean, very odd. And it's very good to see Bates taking the lead in addressing this kind of problem, and I hope that it's an example that spreads to a lot of other places. I'm extremely glad that all day long while I've been here, people keep offering me water in glasses with a pitcher, I gotta say. That's very good. So the good news is that one can imagine the world. On the other side of cheap fossil fuel. And we can imagine it a little bit all the time. And we were talking about this a lot today as we were thinking about things like local food initiatives and stuff here in the Anskagen. Take food as a good example, because it's the most basic of commodities. It seems normal to us that food would travel 1,500 miles to reach our lips on average, okay? But in fact, that's quite strange. I mean, A, it means that it arrives marinated in crude oil, you know. It takes a lot of energy to do that. If you want to eat this time of year lettuce from California, one calorie of that lettuce getting out here took about 50 calories of fossil energy to grow and to transport. Not a good ratio, okay? It's also worth noting that it doesn't really taste like very much, okay? I came almost 1,500 miles to get here today. I know how I feel. That's how the tomato feels also, you know, when it gets here. So it's good to see that the fastest growing part of the food economy in the country for the last 7 or 8 years has been local farmers markets. Their numbers have doubled and then doubled again. Sales are growing very fast. They're most heavily patronized in the inner city and among recent ethnic immigrants to this country, people who can still remember what food tastes like and are unwilling to accept the simulations on offer at the Hannaford, you know. It's very good to see that happening, not just for ecological reasons, but even more for community reasons. A pair of sociologists a few years ago followed shoppers, first around the supermarket, then around the farmer's market. You all have been to the supermarket. You know how it works. You walk in. You fall into a light fluorescent trance. You visit the stations of the cross around the supermarket. You emerge with the same basket of items. Maybe you have the very interesting paper or plastic discussion at the checkout. That's about it. Okay? When they followed people around the farmer's market, they were having, on average, 10 times more conversations per visit. That's a lot. A very lot. It's an order of magnitude more. You know, you don't need to be a social scientist to figure out its statistical significance. That's a different world. Okay? It's the kind of world that begins working to re-knit community together. And I would wager that the conversation is as attractive to people as the produce. You can do the same argument with almost any commodity you name. Think about energy itself, okay? We're used to the idea that it's going to come from a long ways. And instead of, you know, General Mills or Archer Daniels Midland, it'll be Exxon or Peabody Coal or something. Doesn't need to be that way. The sort of best buzzword among the smartest engineers in recent years has been distributed generation. In essence, almost, a kind of farmer's market in energy. I have solar panels all over my roof in Vermont, okay? On a day like today, I'm a utility. I'm tied to the grid, and I'm sending electrons, you know, before my neighbor switches on Jerry Remy in the evening to watch the game, he's cooling his beer with the sunlight that falls on my shingles, okay? That's not only an ecologically improved way of doing things, it also has all kinds of other benefits. You know, think about the vulnerability of the kind of jury-rigged system that we've got going to get us energy. You have to be pretty darn optimistic to imagine it lasting very far into the lives of people now in college. Among other things, it requires having an enormous military to guard the 5,000-mile-long straw through which we suck hydrocarbons out of the Persian Gulf. Vermont has lost more of its citizens per capita in the war in Iraq than any state in the Union. We are enormously tired of going to funerals, but I'm willing to wager that we'll be going to them as long as the central part of our economy depends on resources that lie beneath somebody else's sand. Much better to have it lie on our own rooftops or our own ridgelines or wherever we're going to find it. You can even do the same argument with very soft commodities, okay? Music, let's take as an example. We're used to the same kind of central, you know, somebody in Hollywood or Nashville makes a piece of music, puts it in a hard-to-open plastic box, and sends it to us, and that's how it works. That system is breaking down. Now, I'm sure it's not anybody here at Bates, but some students at other colleges have figured out how to use their computers to download music illegally. Have you heard about this? And far be it from me to, you know, sanction that or anything, but the record company executives a few years ago, when this was sort of first beginning to happen, always made the same argument. They said, well, if this keeps going on, there'll be no incentive for people to make music anymore, okay? In essence, there'll be no more music, all right? Whatever one's opinion of the sort of, I mean, that's not going to happen, all right? Every culture we know about makes music, and it won't surprise you, given what I've said, to learn that the fastest growing parts of the music industry by far are local live performance and festivals. That is, music consumed in the company of others, and where much of the pleasure comes from the company of others, all right? That's the world that beckons on the other side. And the question is, how do we get there fast enough to keep the world that we're in from completely unraveling, from making that transition almost impossible because of the damage that we do before we get there? The only way, I think, and here I'm going to turn to the work that I'll end soon. I know I've gone on a long time already, but the work I've been doing in the last few years. The only way that we're going to get there in time is if we're able to make very large-scale national and global changes in the way we use energy. All right? The only way we're going to do it, I wish I could tell you in good conscience that the way that we should proceed is simply to go to work in our own homes and communities and change our light bulbs and drive the right kind of car and take mass transit and ride the bike and grow local food. Those are all things I completely believe in. I mean, I have a prize for having the most energy-efficient house in Vermont. You know, my daughter, who is a big Harry Potter fan, refers to me as the Dark Lord because I turn out the lights so, you know, assiduously. I've fed my family for a year with only food grown in our valley in Vermont. You know, on and on and on. But I got to tell you the truth. You can't make the math work fast enough to close the gap between what we need to do, you know, in the time that we have. Rajendra Pachauri, the Indian-born head of the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the scientific body charged with studying all this, said recently that if we have not made major changes by 2012 in the ways that we use energy, if we haven't really begun to turn this ocean liner around, it'll be too late. The momentum of these changes, these feedback loops, will be too intense. We won't be able ever to really get a hold of the problem. 2012, correct me if I'm wrong, but people who entered college last fall are going to graduate in 2012, okay? Not much use waiting until you get out of school to do something about this, okay? We need your help right now. We need to build a movement large enough to force real change in the price of energy, which is what it will take to cause people all around the world, even if they don't know or care about global warming, to change their habits enough, to change our economies enough, to birth new technologies fast enough to make some kind of dent in this problem. And it is at heart a political process that we have to engage in. Okay? You can't do it one light bulb at a time, but maybe we can do it one treaty at a time if we put our energy into forcing that kind of political change. That's what I think anyway. And I really started thinking that after 15 or 16 years of writing about this stuff when I came back home from that trip to Bangladesh and just no longer felt like writing and speaking about all this was enough. Figured that it was time to do something, even if only to make myself feel a little better, you know. I'm quite capable of that level of solipsistic self-absorption, okay. I didn't know what to do. I'm a writer. I live in Vermont. I like to sit in my room and type, you know. I'm not by nature a kind of politician. I called up some of my other writer friends in Vermont. We've got to do something. Let's go up to Burlington, and we'll sit in on the steps of the federal building, and we'll be arrested, and there'll be a little story in the paper, okay? And at least people have done something. And all these other writers, they're as clueless as I. Okay, that sounds like a very excellent idea. Let's do that, you know? And happily, somebody calls up to the police in Burlington. What will happen if we do this intrepid stunt, you know? And the police say, nothing will happen. Stay there as long as you want, you know. We'll come visit you down, you know. And this isn't going to work. We have to recalibrate. So I just started sending out emails to everybody I knew. So we're going to go for a walk, okay? Come join us. And we left a couple of weeks later. This was right before Labor Day in 2006. And we left from Robert Frost's old summer writing cabin up in the green. He's sort of our patron saint, you know, in Vermont. And we like the most cliched of all high school English class poems about the road not taken seemed very apropos, you know. Off we go marching. We walk for 5 days and, you know, we sleep in fields at night. I'm a Methodist Sunday school teacher, so I've called up all the Methodist churches. We're doing programs there along the way, you know. So we get to Vermont and there's 1,000 people marching. Now, Maine is very cosmopolitan and, you know, large place. What you have to understand in Vermont is that 1,000 people is an unbelievable horde of people, and except for maybe UVM hockey game, no one's ever seen 1,000, you know, cows kind of running in terror from the fence line, you know, at this procession. And it's way more than enough people to get everybody who's running for Congress or Senate in this fall 2006 to come meet with us. Not just meet with us. We've been carrying this raggedy piece of cardboard across the state, you know, and it says, I pledge that I will work to cut carbon emissions 80% by 2050 if I'm elected. They all sign, not just the liberal Democrats, of whom we knew Bernie Sanders was going to sign this, you know, but the conservative Republicans also. The woman who was running for Congress on the GOP ticket and who almost won, the adjutant general of our state National Guard, had said 2 months before, when she announced her candidacy, she said what too many politicians, I'm not sure this is real, more research needs to be done. It turned out that the more research that needed to be done was about how many people would walk across Vermont and ask her to change her mind. And empirically, 1,000 was enough because she signed, okay? Which was very good for all of us to see, me and the mostly college-age kids that I was working with, because we'd allowed ourselves to become more cynical about, remember this was pre-Obama, you know, more cynical than we should have about politics. And it was good to see it work. The only bad part was to open the paper the next day, and there's this story that says these 1,000 people may have been the largest demonstration about global warming that's ever taken place in the United States. You're like, well, no wonder we're getting nowhere. You know, we have the experts, we have the economists, we have the scientists, we have policy people. We just don't have any movement to back them up. You know, that was the part that we forgot, okay? And so we're losing. And no big surprise. I mean, ExxonMobil, the last 3 years, has made more money than any company in the history of money, all right? In our system, that buys you lots of political influence. And with no counterweight on the other side, it's no surprise that we weren't getting anywhere. We decided to see what we could do. We started this website in January of 2007 called Step It Up, okay? And we sent out email. When I say we, me and six college kids at Middlebury. They were seniors. They weren't done with school, but they were done with school, if you know what I mean. And they were ready to work really hard. And we didn't have any money. We didn't have any mailing list. We just started asking people to organize demonstrations in their own places. Okay, 3 months later, in April, we thought maybe we could organize 100 of these things, which would have been 100 more than there had been. We didn't tell anyone. It seemed grandiose. Instead, the thing just took off. People all over the place, including people sitting in this room, in their own places, picked up this and ran with it. And on that April 14th, we had 1,400 simultaneous demonstrations in all 50 states. It was the biggest day of grassroots environmental action since the first Earth Day. It was extraordinarily beautiful. We'd resisted. People had told us who knew what they were doing that what we needed to do was have a march on Washington, because that's what had happened sort of the last time people had. And, you know, it was we didn't have the resources to do it, and we also thought there was something off about telling people to drive across the country to protest global warming. I was extremely happy we made that decision, because as those images began to roll in from around the country, it was clear that in their own local places with their neighbors, people had been able to incarnate this idea in very powerful ways. Key West, Florida. Only coral reefs in the continental U.S. Coral reefs, an ecosystem that's not going to be there in 50 years if we keep warming the planet. It's already under unbelievable stress, okay? They did an underwater demonstration. Lots and lots of people in scuba gear down there with signs, 80% emission, okay? Big fish swimming in a sort of interspecies, you know, collaboration. It was great. Further up in Jacksonville, Florida, I've never been to Jacksonville, Florida. My sense is it's different than Vermont. And, you know, the place they held their thing was in the parking lot of the Jacksonville Jaguars NFL stadium, okay? Because in this fall, that's sort of where community is. They have big tailgate parties and things. This was a spring, so they hold it there. Somebody brings a yacht and somebody rents a crane. And they winch this thing 20 foot up in the air. And then they, you know, look, or ahoy, or something. That's when Greenland slides into the ocean, that's where the ocean will be. And you could just hear people all over, just, yeah, okay, I get it. I understand now which time I'm. I started the day in Lower Manhattan, and there were thousands of us in blue shirts, and everybody's holding arms like this, okay? And human tideline, we called it. Manhattanites view the world partly through the lens of real estate. We wanted to show them what real estate was going to be underwater before long. You know, it was very powerful all around the country, including right here, people doing magnificent things. Not only beautiful, but effective. 3 days later, both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama changed their energy and environmental platforms, toughened them very considerably to take this 80% target as their goal. And we're seeing some of the fruits of that now. If you listen, Obama uses that number a lot. And he's done more in 3 weeks, or 4 weeks, whatever it is now, to address global warming than all the presidents of the global warming era before him. Bill Clinton talked about it a lot. He did nothing. George Bush operated on the premise that if he pretended not to notice, it would go away. And, you know, it didn't. And now we're seeing something, the beginning of something, the possibility of something. We've got someone now who will listen. We've got to give them the space to do the work that I think they want to do, the political space, which is why we've got a new campaign underway that we very badly need your help with. And it's called, do you remember that most important number in the world that I told you a little while ago? 350. It's called 350.org. Okay. Now, that's a strange title for a campaign. It's not a sort of charismatic slogan or something, but that's on purpose for two reasons. One, it holds our leaders to some kind of standard, just in its name. In December of this year, in Copenhagen in Denmark, the leaders of the world are going to come together for a final negotiation of a treaty that's supposed to replace the Kyoto Accords. Even a few years ago, we would have said that this would be a kind of evolutionary step and we'd include some more countries and the targets would get harder. And given what we now know about the science, it's pretty clear that this is the last plausible bite at the apple we're going to get as a world to get something serious enough to really dent the momentum toward climate change. It becomes extraordinarily important. If those negotiations were held today, they'd produce a tepid and pointless document. There'd be an agreement. Those guys are not all going to come someplace and then walk away with nothing, okay? But it would be an agreement that would lock us into a scenario where we would never get back to 350. It would be a disaster. If we can get that number out there enough, then perhaps we'll be able to sort of set the psychological bar for those negotiations, move them at least somewhat in the direction of the science. The other reason we chose the number is because this is a global problem and a global campaign. And it's pretty tough to do global campaigns, in part because people all over the world insist on speaking their own languages. And this makes any kind of, you'll notice that the only people who've done sort of successful global branding campaigns are like McDonald's and Coca-Cola, and the content is very low, okay? Coke is down, their slogan at the moment is, Coke is it, okay? You know, almost entirely devoid of, and the reason for that is that their last slogan, those of you a little older, remember when the Coke slogan was, Coke adds life, okay? Which they abandoned because when they apparently across large swaths of Africa, when they translated it, in billboards and things, the billboards said, Coke brings your ancestors back from the dead. Okay? Which is sort of sample of why it is difficult to do this kind of work. Arabic numerals translate across boundaries very easily. 350 means same thing every place. So here's the plan, such as it is. Okay. On October 24th of this year, huge global day of action, just like that Step It Up thing, but on a worldwide scale, with actions going on everywhere and all just designed to make sure that by the next day, this number is known by everyone or as close to everyone as we can get. And we'll have climbers high up in the Himalayas, you know, doing things and 350 divers down on the Great Barrier Reef, and I just talked last week to the research team that's going to be on Easter Island, sort of poster child for what happens when you ignore environmental troubles, and they're going to string banners across the noses of those large stone guys, you know, and on and on and on all over the world. We have good networks now across the developing world. In fact, the web gives us the possibility to even contemplate something this size that we couldn't have contemplated even a few years ago. And it's enormously moving to open the email and find that some farmer in the Cameroon has heard about this. Someone's texted it to him on his cell phone. And he's understood it, and he's gone in with his neighbors. They've planted 350 trees on the edge of the village, and they've hung a little sign with this logo on it and taken a picture with the cell phone. Moving because you know for damn sure that nobody in Cameroon is causing global warming, okay? But they've figured out that they can be some part of the solution, that they are connected to the rest of the world in some way. They're going to have a delegation at these negotiations, and their delegation, we were able to take that picture and get it on the front page of the newspaper in whatever the main city in Cameroon is the next day, okay? If all goes well on October 24th, at the very least, the world will know what the stakes are. They'll have some idea of the predicament we're in and the kind of action that we need our leaders to take. Maybe even more than the world. I was telling people at dinner that I got a call the other day from some tycoon in Hong Kong. He said, "We have a satellite that you could borrow on the 24th. If you can think of something big enough, you know, to photograph from space, we'll make sure to fly over it and take a picture, you know." So we're thinking already. We've got our, and if you have any ideas, let me know. But it would be extraordinarily useful, one, for you guys to do something beautiful here. And we've already been starting to talk today about what it might be, but we want it to be big and beautiful, something that'll make the front page of the local paper and of the Globe, and we'll be able to send that image all over the place, and everyone will see it. That's one thing we need. And the other thing we need, because this is one of these places that's connected to the rest of the world, where people study abroad, where people have strong international interests, we need you to take your email address book and go to work for us, okay? Sending this message out to people you know around this country and around the world to get them to organize things too. It's not going to happen from me doing it, okay? I have 7 people working full-time on this. That means that each of them is responsible for a continent, okay? We can provide some materials and whatever, but we've got 8 months. The only chance we really have is the viral power of the net and your willingness to put it to work, okay? To make this happen, to write a letter to people you know explaining what I've talked about, or to forward the one that's on our website to places around the world and people around the world and keep on them until they agree to do something wherever they are and be a part of this. And you'll find, especially around the world, that people may be eager to feel as if they're a part of something large and global that has some hope of changing the quite dismal odds at the moment. And it's there I will end. And end without promising too much. I have no idea if this will work. And if one was betting, man, one would guess that probably not. Not this or not anything else. The name of the book I wrote about this 20 years ago was The End of Nature. Okay, it's quite plausible to say that we've gone too far already, that the physical momentum of these systems is too strong. But the best science tells us we have a small window open, a window that is closing quickly, but that we might, with a great deal of work and luck, be able to get through. And so it becomes morally incumbent upon us to try. This is different from other social problems that we faced, in that it's limited by time. I've been thinking about this a lot in the last year, because of course last spring passed the 40th anniversary of the assassination of Dr. King. And so they kept replaying on the TV that speech he gave the night before he died. You've all seen it, where I said, "I've been to the mountaintop, I've seen the promised land. I don't know if I'll get there with you, but I know that you will get there." They had to be way braver. No one's going to shoot you for talking about global warming, okay? But they had the great luxury of knowing they were going to win in the end. Martin Luther King always said at the end of talks, he would quote from Theodore Parker, the abolitionist, "The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. We're going to win. The arc of the physical universe is short, and it bends toward heat." Okay? And we're going to lose unless in the next few years we are able to summon up creativity and courage that we have not shown before and build a movement of a kind that we have not seen before. And you guys can and should be instrumental parts of that. And I'm so grateful to you for being here tonight, and I'm so grateful to you in advance for doing the things that will make that happen. Thank you all very much. Thank you all very much. I may have talked, if I talked so long, we still have a little time for questions.
We do.
And I won't feel bad at all if anybody leaves, because I know I've just rattled on.
No, this has been wonderful, and I know some people may need to leave, but I know that others may want to ask or comment and be in dialogue with you, and I just ask them to let me get to you with the microphone first. So, questions, thoughts for Bill McKibben? Hang on a sec.
I was just curious. You brought up a lot of really scary things, and a lot of people that I know get kind of overwhelmed when they hear all of that. Do you have any tips or things that you would say? Because it seems like a lot of people move from ignorance towards just being completely overwhelmed and it's unproductive.
Absolutely.
Almost.
And sometimes I feel that way too, and I'm sorry to the extent that I as I say at the beginning, treated you entirely as sort of competent to handle the truth, but none of us are quite competent really to emotionally handle truths of this scale. So, I apologize for that. I think that the two things that make it possible to go on working hard on it nonetheless are, one, having some kind of vision of what the world looks like on the other side, and that's what I was trying to describe with the sort of more localized economy and community that I think we can and should build, partly because it's the kind of thing we'll need to survive those changes that we can't ward off, and partly because it'll help us ward off much of the change that's coming. We can build much more sensible societies. The other way, to sort of keep a grip and whatever, is to have something to do, which is why I, don't go talk anymore without the ability to tell people something that they can do. And this 350 thing is something that you can do, and not only do, but have a great deal of fun doing, okay? If it works right, on October 24th, whatever you do will not be dismal and long-faced, and it won't even need to be angry. It'll be something beautiful and fun and joyful and creative, and it'll model some vision of what that world that might be on the other side might look like, and it'll be as enticing to people as the alternative prospect is scary. So that's as good as I can give you, I fear.
Phil Donahue here.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It was absolutely wonderful. I'd like to draw you into a further answer of this young man's question with a question of my own, and that is, do you believe that every form of moral refinement, since you did make mention of morality, contributes to moral refinement in all or in every other regard? So if it were to be that we understood 350, us getting there, to be moral refinement, someone who would otherwise feel that they didn't have a specific relationship to that and engendering hope, could they feel that they're improving otherwise, it's making a contribution?
Yeah, if I'm hearing you correctly, One way I would say that is that I think the world on the other side of cheap fossil fuel, the 350 world that I'm talking about, is a world that begins finally to address not just the deep peril, ecological peril that we find ourselves in, but also, frankly, a host of other problems that we've allowed much too long to fester on this planet. These negotiations, for instance, that are going to go on in Copenhagen are extraordinarily interesting because they'll mark the first time that the developing world, the poor world, comes to the table with real leverage. Okay? China and India burn all the coal they've got. Doesn't matter what we do. They can keep us above 350 forever. Okay? At the same time, they understand that they'll be mortally damaged by that themselves. But it means that there's going to have to be a different kind of respect paid in the future than there's been in the past, all around this world. Our stewardship of the planet from this country actually has worked out badly. You know, there are certain things of which we can be proud, the fight against fascism, whatever else, but in the largest terms, our solution for how to do things that we've spread around the world turns out not to have been the panacea that we imagined. And so across a wide variety of issues, it's time now for people to be able to pay more attention to different answers, different ideas, different people, different messages. And so I think that there's a very deep part of what you say that is very right.
Hi. Sorry. First, I just want to express my sincere gratitude to all the dedication and time and passion you've put behind this. My question is, I came across something a few months ago that just seemed a little bit too good to be true, and I wanted your opinion on it in regards to someone making a suggestion for part of the solution, and that was painting rooftops white. What's the real answer to this? Can that really help replace some of the lost snow and ice and all of that?
Yes, but not all that much of it, okay? But it's a very good way of getting at something important that we need to think about technologically, okay? Which is that there's no silver bullet solution to this problem. We've already had our magic fuel. Coal, gas, and oil were it, okay? So all the things that we're going to do in response, as soon as the price of energy, as soon as we're able to drive the price of energy up some, okay, we'll start doing all kinds of things. But there'll have to be thousands of, there's no one-for-one replacement. So there's conservation. That's the cheapest and easiest first step to take, okay? And so as soon as the price, remember what happened last year when the price of gas went to $4 a gallon, okay? People, for the first time, Americans stopped driving so much, or we drove less than we had the year before. All right? We'll find lots of other things to do, like paint our rooftops, like biochar in our soils, like a lot more no-till agriculture, like public transit, like solar and wind power, and we'll quickly learn to appreciate the sight of windmills spinning in the distance, you know, on and on and on. No silver bullet, maybe enough silver buckshot if we pick it all up, okay? So yeah, painting every roof in the country white would help a little bit, okay? And we'll probably do something like it when we get serious. We won't get serious until the price changes. And the trick is going to be raising the price of fossil fuel without bankrupting everybody in America. And there is a way to do this, and this is the one sort of policy thing I want you to go away with, because it's the thing that Obama is heading towards, and it's going to be the central policy debate of this stuff for the next year. You have to concentrate for just a minute, okay? We've got to put a cap on carbon, right? Scientists tell us we're putting way too much in, we've got to be lowering it. That'll have, as any economist in the room will tell you, the immediate effect of making carbon very valuable, i.e., the permit that you need to put it into the atmosphere will be a valuable thing. So what you do is you have Exxon and Peabody Coal and whatever bid each year for the rights to those permits to put carbon into the atmosphere, and you make fewer of them each year as you try to drive the amount down as fast as you can, all right? So here's the question. What happens to the money, and it's going to be a lot of money, maybe $300 billion the first year, that all those companies pay for those permits? They're going to pass the cost of them on to all of us, right? Gasoline will go back to being $4 a gallon. That's why this works, because it'll then change our habits and decisions and patterns. But instead of taking that $300 million and giving it to Congress to do with it what it will, okay, because, among other things, Congress hasn't chosen very wisely. I mean, ethanol was their first attempt at how to deal with this, and we know how that turned out. Instead, what the proposal is simply to take that pot of money and write a check to every person in the country every year for their share. All right? So you'd still get the price signal at the pump or at the home heating oil thing or wherever. There'd still be a strong price signal to drive new technologies, to drive changes like getting people to paint their roofs white, whatever it is. But you wouldn't bankrupt people. In fact, poor people would get back considerably more money probably than they put in, because proportionately use less energy than rich people. They're calling it, the name at the moment that people are referring to this scheme is cap and dividend, okay? And it's the one that the Obama administration seems to be moving toward, and it'll be a very interesting turn in sort of, among other things, political theory, and you could see how it might be attractive to both liberals and conservatives in certain different ways, okay? I think it's probably the bargain we're going to need to strike, and maybe something like it on a global basis too, if we're going to have any hope of building a cap that lasts more than one election cycle, that doesn't defeat whoever voted for it, okay? It's none of this is ideal, but that's the scheme that we're working towards.
Got time for one or two more questions?
Yeah, I was wondering, suppose we miss that closing window of opportunity, what would kind of be the sequence of events following that? I know it sounds like kind of a grim question, but...
But you're smiling, so, you know. Look, we don't know exactly everything that happens, but basically, you know, a pretty steady unraveling of many of the things that we count on. And... You know, we'd first see it here through a variety, you know, I mean, we're already beginning to see this happening, right? Winter at this latitude on average is shorter by a few weeks than it was 30 years ago, and that'll get much shorter yet, okay? This is very painful to me. My great vice in the world is cross-country skiing, all right? In fact, I can report to you all today that the great bait skier Sylvan Elofsson had an excellent day in the slopes at Rumford today in the NCAA championships. That's where I'm going to go tomorrow to see my Middlebury team. It's going to be very sad for me when winter disappears, but that'll be the least of our troubles. Probably the most dramatic thing that we'll see over the course of this century, if we don't get things under control, is a pretty rapid rise in the level of the ocean. Okay. It's going to rise a couple of feet anyway, just because of thermal expansion. Warm water takes up more space than cold water does, all right? But, and that's tough to begin with. A couple of feet, you know, the average eastern beach, not so much on the rocky shore of Maine, but for most of the East Coast, the average beach slopes in at about 1 degree. You raise the water a foot, and it comes 90 feet further in, okay? So, that, you know, that kind of stuff's tough to begin with. But we now think, because Greenland and the West Antarctic seem to be growing unstable more quickly than we had imagined, that it's more likely to be something like 6 feet in the course of this century, and that's really a kind of civilization-challenging number, you know? That makes most coastal cities in the world something like New Orleans, you know? Very vulnerable all the time. There's really not enough money on Earth to cope with changes of that scale. So that's the kind of trouble that we get into. And it'll pinch hardest first for poorest people, especially in low-lying parts of the tropics. But it'll get all of us in trouble sooner rather than later, which is why it would be a very good idea to try to head off as much of it as we can. We're not going to head off all of it. It's already warmed. We've already warmed a degree, and we've probably put enough carbon in the atmosphere to guarantee a little more than another degree. Okay? There's a lag time before it fully warms. The ocean holds some of the heat for a while. What we're trying to do now is prevent it from getting completely out of hand, trying to see if we can get the Earth back below that 350 number in time before we have the truly massive heart attack, planetary heart attack, that, you know, really would just be catastrophic. So that's what this is about, and it's much too early to give up hope on it. It's precisely the time to try to work very hard on it. So I thank you in advance for doing that.
And a last question.
It's a pressure. Yeah. hi, thank you very much. I'm the AmeriCorps VISTA here at Bates, and I've been working a lot with really impoverished people in Lewiston. And I was wondering if you could speak a little bit more about the poor people in America, and especially in Maine with problems with heating and the fact that we rely on fuel for heating, and that it's a catch-22 in Maine when you raise fuel prices, because suddenly there are hundreds of thousands of people, if you go across the country, who can't afford
There's
heat.
Probably more than that. I mean, we were very, Vermont's just the same way. And, I mean, we were very scared when oil prices were as high as they were last summer that this winter was going to be a complete debacle. I'm on the volunteer fire department in our town, and we were certain that we were going to be having, you know, I mean, when oil prices get high enough, you wouldn't believe the stuff that people start throwing in their wood stoves just to keep warm. And we were pretty certain it was going to be a grim winter in that regard. The real answer to that question is that we need to get to work changing the homes of poor people, especially around the Northeast, around the whole country. Okay, it's absurd that we have people who can barely afford to heat their homes heating the outdoors of Maine and Vermont and whatever all winter long. Okay, absurd and completely unnecessary. We should, and we will at least a little bit with some of the money from this stimulus package, but we should be spending more of it weatherizing those homes as fast as we can. Okay, not only does it make energy sense, it makes economic sense, both because people use a lot less energy and don't have to come up with as much money next year, but also because this is the definition of a kind of green job, i.e., nobody's going to put their house on a boat and send it to China to get insulated. You pretty much have to do it here, you know? And all the people who aren't swinging hammers building crappy condominiums that nobody wants anymore and are out of work need to have something else to do, and this is the obvious and clear thing to be doing. It requires, I think, a stronger community sense than we've yet shown. And one of the problems with that hyper-individualism into which we've fallen is the ease with which it's allowed us to ignore the plight of all kinds of other people around us. And so part of the value of this move back towards community, it comes if we begin to take energy seriously and global warming seriously, is that it reminds us that we have all kinds of duties towards our neighbors, that working communities are communities that don't leave people behind. We can't afford to keep doing what we've been doing for sheer practical reasons, if nothing else. We need communities where people aren't struggling like that. And this is one of the opportunities we have to build them, not just here, but around the world. Because one of the things you really fixate on when you start thinking very much about this is what the definition of poor really is. And as poor as people are who are poor in America, the poverty of billions of people around the world is so profound. And the easiest, cheapest way out of that poverty would be to burn the coal that they have close to hand, just like we did, that we're going to need the same kind of ethic of sharing to one degree or another internationally as we will in our own communities. The only way out of this fix, I think, is to figure out how to get away from some of that incredible individualism that's marked our time and move quickly, powerfully, for moral reasons, but also for very pragmatic ones, toward a much stronger sense of community than we've had in the past. There is no individual escape from a problem as large as global warming. The only possibility is building the boat together that will let us, you know, ride above those particular waves. So that's a very good question on which to end, and thank you all very much.
Thank you, Jeff. Thanks so much, Bill, for inspiring us and scaring us all at the same time.